This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A game of nuclear chicken. That's how my guest Joseph Cerincione describes the relationship between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. We asked him to explain the situation and what the consequences might be. Cerincione is the Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the co-author of Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats, and he's completing a book about nuclear weapons in the 21st century. Over the weekend, the 35-nation board of the IAEA approved a resolution to report Iran to the UN Security Council in 1 month's time if Iran continues to defy the agency. Iran has refused to comply with the agency's demand to close its uranium enrichment plant. Enriched uranium could be used to produce electricity or to build a nuclear weapon. In response to the resolution, Iran has ended voluntary cooperation with the agency, will no longer allow inspections, and has said it will resume its nuclear operations. Iran's top nuclear negotiator has said nobody would dare to attack Iran. All the experts say there is a minimal possibility for this option. Is he right?
Yes. The military option is very unattractive. I mean, it's always there. Of course, we could hit a site. Many of the sites are hardened. The centrifuge experimental site at Natanz, for example, is deeply buried underground. It would be very hard to take out with a bomb. There are many sites that would be a big target set, but some of them are exposed. My target of choice would be the uranium conversion plant at Isfahan. I actually visited that plant in March of 2005. It's above ground. It's exposed. There's some anti-aircraft batteries there, but it's nothing we couldn't handle. You could take that out, and it would be a choke point. You would knock out Iran's ability to turn uranium into gas. That's the necessary step they need to make the gas that they then put in the centrifuges. But the problem is what happens next. What does Iran do then? And there are a half dozen really terrible possibilities, including a military reaction, perhaps a military reaction by proxy. The Shia-based militia in Iraq could start attacking U.S. forces in Iraq. The Shia-dominated government of Iraq could decide that's it. They'll just ask the U.S. to leave. There could be an oil embargo where Iran would turn off the taps. That would send oil spiking to $100 a barrel, gas to $5 a gallon. The international economy would be reeling. And this is the worst part. The strike wouldn't actually stop the program. It would probably accelerate it. All bets would be off. Iran would go pedal to the metal. All of those in Iran who said, see, we need a nuclear bomb to stop the U.S. from attacking us would be proven right. And you could probably have a bomb in Iran in a shorter amount of time than is otherwise the case.
Okay, so you're arguing that the military option wouldn't be very effective, and I think you're also arguing that nobody's really seriously considering it. But Senator McCain has said there's only one thing worse than the U.S. exercising a military option, and that's a nuclear-armed Iran. So are there people in the American government who are seriously considering a military option now?
Well, no official has said that. The closest you get is the kinds of statements you hear from political leaders. I take this as partially posturing. You know, you want to show you're strong. You want to show you're tough. And you also get it from the media, both media like Fox News, which loves to present all this as a crisis, as an imminent threat, or even the Washington Post, who in their editorial over the weekend on Sunday talked about an alliance without muscle, that the diplomatic group of countries that passed this resolution needs to back it up with military force. And you get this from neoconservatives in the country, for whom the military option is always the option of choice, and they don't really believe, have any faith in the multilateral institutions. So it becomes more of a political or a sort of a commercial issue in this country. But I don't get any sense whatsoever from anyone in the leadership of the White House or the Congress that this is seriously being considered. It's more of a posture than a policy.
How has our use of the military option in Iraq affected how political leaders are thinking now about the possible use of the military in Iran?
The war in Iraq has handcuffed the U.S. with Iran. Ironically, by invading a country that didn't have nuclear weapons, we put ourselves in a more difficult position to deal with a country that's trying to get them. We have a big credibility gap, for example. When the U.S. officials talk about Iranian weapons programs, it sounds a lot like what we're saying about Iraq. So nobody takes our word for this anymore. When we say that we want to bring Iran before the Security Council, a number of countries are very worried that we're pulling the Iraq gambit again. And they don't want to be part of this trap. They don't want to have the U.S. use the United Nations as a staging ground for another military adventure, even a limited strike. It also puts a lot of assets on the ground that are now possibly threatened by Iranian actions. We have troops that are in very vulnerable positions in Iraq. It's bad enough they're being attacked by the Sunni insurgents. If we were to actually take military action against Iran, there could be a Shia uprising against us, and that would jeopardize the entire already fragile position of the U.S. in Iraq. So it weakens us in all those ways.
The Iranian government spokesperson said, "We're in a position of power when it comes to energy." And he said that sanctions would hurt the consumers, not the producers, referring there to the fact that Iran has a lot of oil. So how much credibility does he have when he says Iran is in the position of power when it comes to energy?
He has a lot of credibility. The Russian negotiator said something similar. When it comes to sanctions, he says, it's hard to see who would be sanctioning who. No one in the U.S. is talking about the kind of blanket sanctions that would get countries to stop buying Iranian oil. We don't buy any oil from Iran. The U.S. doesn't. But, of course, oil is fungible. Somebody else is buying it. And as long as they're buying it, that frees up other supplies, etc. If Iran were to cut it off, if they were to turn their taps off, even for a month, that would have a serious impact on global economies. China's, India's big customers of Iran, key to getting the diplomatic alliance that's now put a noose around Iran. The Western economies would immediately take a hit. It's a real problem. That's why your ability to affect Iranian behavior is actually quite limited.
Yeah, so what are our options? You say that nobody's really seriously considering a military option. Sanctions could actually hurt the world oil situation. So, well, you know, what's left?
Well, the administration is actually approaching this very well, I think. They're playing our weak hand very cleverly, and they've proceeded step by step to unite all those countries that can be united, as the Chinese used to say. They've learned the lesson from the Iraq War. This is not something that a coalition of the willing can solve. You can't get the U.S. and the U.K. and Poland to solve this problem. You need Russia. You need China. You need India. These countries have to agree to diplomatically isolate Iran. That already has an impact. They do not want to be brought to the Security Council. This is a humiliation for the Iranians. And behind this strategy is one that focuses all our actions on isolating the Iranian government, in fact, isolating the particular faction of the Iranian government, the one headed by President Ahmadinejad, and showing that his policies, his rhetoric, will make the situation worse for Iran. And the hope is that this will open up fissures within the Iranian elite. And you already see some evidence of this. Over the weekend, the man that Ahmadinejad beat in the election for president of Iran, or Mr. Rafsanjani, was quoted as being critical of Ahmadinejad's policy, of saying that this is backfiring on us, that we had to go back to the policies he was promoting a couple of years ago that were engagement with the West, negotiations with the West, etc. Remember, this is a very unpopular regime inside Iran. This is the only issue Ahmadinejad has working for him. The economy is not performing well. His Islamic policies, for example, trying to ban Western music or backfiring. The entire theocratic rule is very unpopular inside Iran. The Iranian population is basically pro-Western, pro-American. So this whole issue is the only thing he has going for him. He's used it very well. He's stirred up nationalism. He has rallies of tens of thousands of Iranians seeing him as a defender of Iranian rights. But should this backfire, should it be seen as the whole world against Iran and not just the Western imperialists or the U.S. colonialists, then he could lose support very rapidly. So the strategy's got to be to isolate him diplomatically. And the next step of this is going to be a series of resolutions at the United Nations leading possibly to targeted sanctions, to sanctions directed at the Iranian leadership that would restrict their travel, seize their assets. Again, hit them, but not don't hit the Iranian population. And that way you might head off any move by Iran to actually cut off the oil supplies.
So what has the U.S. strategy been to get Russia and China to come on board on trying to pressure Iran?
Patience and compromise. That is, they let the negotiations with the European Union run their course. The U.S. softened its rhetoric over the last year. They let the Europeans take the lead. They encouraged Russia to get involved. Russia's got a sidetrack to all of this, where they're trying to convince Iran to compromise and a compromise that would let the Iranian nuclear power program go ahead, build the reactors, etc. Russia's building the Bushehr reactor, for example, but do all the enrichment of the uranium, that dangerous part of the fuel cycle where you can enrich uranium either for fuel rods or bombs, do all of that outside Iran in Russia itself. And then you built up support at the IAEA Board of Governors. In part, and one of the things that's changed a bit is the Director General of the IAEA, Mohammed Al-Baradei, has become much more hard-hitting in his report. And his report played a crucial role in getting the vote this weekend. And then the rhetoric of the Iranian government has backfired on it. Many countries now see Ahmadinejad as a dangerous demagogue, someone who can't be trusted, someone who's talking about throwing Israel into the sea and the Holocaust is a myth. This has really set back the Iranian diplomatic effort. All these things have come together to help forge this coalition of now 27 of the 35 nations at the Board of Governors voting to report Iran to the Security Council.
My guest is Joseph Cirincione, Director of Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joseph Cirincione, and he's the Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The resolution that the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency came up with has a clause in it that reads that a solution to the Iranian nuclear issue would contribute to a goal of a Middle East free of all weapons of mass destruction and their means of delivery. This is actually a very controversial clause. Why is it controversial?
This was actually part of the compromise that was reached over Friday and Saturday. It wasn't in the original European and U.S. proposal, but some of the other countries spoke heavily in favor of it, particularly the Arab countries in the region, particularly Egypt, who wanted this. Frankly, it should have been part of the U.S. proposal all along. This is U.S. policy. We're in favor of this. Israel itself has said, yes, they're in favor of this in the long run. But for many countries, they want to make sure that this whole problem isn't seen as just a problem of Iran, that this is a Middle East problem, that you have an unstable situation in the Middle East. And they're right. You can't have a region where there's only one nuclear power right now, Israel. Historically, that leads either to many nuclear nations or no nuclear nations. And they want to emphasize the no nuclear nations. And the compromise that's worked out is was very clever. It avoided the linkage. The U.S. didn't want to have linkage in this phrase such that Iran ending the program would be linked to Israel giving up its nuclear weapons. But if they wanted to link it the other way around, that Iran's giving up its program could be seen as a step towards actually restarting negotiations regionally that could convince Israel to take some steps that could lead ultimately to no one in the Middle East having nuclear weapons. So I think the resolution is a good thing. It builds support for the overall effort and, in fact, is the way to go.
Does this clause about a nuclear, the goal of a nuclear-free Middle East, does that clause put any immediate pressure on Israel to abandon nuclear weapons?
Not in itself, but it could lead to a process where Iran comes back to the table and starts talking about this. The Director General of the IAEA, Mohammed Al-Baradei, actually was in Jerusalem last year and got Ariel Sharon to reassert Israel's support for a Middle East free of nuclear weapons. He's been trying to get this process going again, and if the U.S. were to back this, you could see the beginning of a forum in the region that discussed nuclear weapons, or some have suggested that it should be a more cooperative security forum where all the countries get together to solve the whole complex of issues, just the way we set up such a system in Europe.
So how come the U.S. is allowed to have nuclear weapons then?
Well, we're not actually allowed to have them. The Non-Proliferation Treaty that was negotiated during the 60s went into force in 1970 when Richard M. Nixon signed it, says that the countries with nuclear weapons will engage in good faith negotiations to reduce and eliminate their arsenals. It doesn't allow us to actually have them. It recognizes that at the time there were five countries that had them, and these five countries would then eventually reduce it. And in exchange, the other countries of the world would sign up and pledge never to acquire nuclear weapons. That treaty's worked remarkably well. In the first 20 years of the nuclear age, we went from one country, the U.S., to five by the mid-1960s that had nuclear weapons. Since that time, since the signing of the NPT, only three other countries have actually acquired nuclear weapons: Israel, India, and Pakistan. And North Korea is knocking out the door. They have enough material for weapons. They may have actually built a few. Iran is the only other case where we have a country we suspect is using a peaceful program, a program for nuclear energy, to acquire the technologies for nuclear weapons, although they're still a good 5 or 10 years away from either. That's a pretty good record. It's not perfect. It's 8 or 9 countries too many, but it's not a bad deal. The danger is that unless those countries that have the weapons, including us, we have 10,000 nuclear weapons. We've cut our arsenal in half in the last 15 years, but to the rest of the world, 10,000 is still a lot of weapons. And if we keep insisting that these are necessary for our security, it's natural that other countries are going to say, well, why aren't they necessary for our security, including Iran, a country, remember, that's actually been attacked by chemical weapons. So you can't maintain this double standard forever. It's going to go one way or the other. Either everyone walks down that nuclear road together, shedding these excess Cold War arsenals, convincing other countries not to acquire nuclear weapons, or you're going to end up in a world where the NPT collapses, where one region and perhaps several regions break out in their own mini arms races, their own nuclear competition, and you end up in the nightmare world that John F. Kennedy tried to warn us about, a world where there are 15, 20, or 25 nuclear nations. That's a recipe for nuclear war. That's why you want to avoid having Iran break out at this point.
We're talking about Iran and its nuclear program and the response of the International Atomic Energy Agency. If Iran did develop a nuclear weapon, then Israel would likely be the country most threatened. The new president of Iran has already said he thinks Israel should be wiped off the map. Israel bombed an Iraqi reactor in the early 80s to prevent the further development of an Iraq nuclear weapons program. Do you think Israel is contemplating a similar military reaction in Iran?
I think some in Israel are contemplating that. It'd be very difficult for Israel to actually carry out such a raid. They'd be stretched militarily to do it. It's a long way to go from Israel to Iran. If they flew over Iraqi territory that the U.S. controls, it would immediately involve in the United States. It'd be a very large target set they'd have to go after, so it would be a big raid. I think that Israel and Israel's leaders are talking tough on this issue as a political move. They want to get the U.S. to solve this problem one way or the other. I seriously doubt whether Israel would launch an attack at this point.
How far is the Iranian nuclear weapons program? What do we know about that?
We actually know a great deal about this program, more than we ever knew about Iraq's program, more than we know about North Korea's program, actually. We've had inspectors there for 3 years. They've been asking lots of questions, have been to lots of sites, haven't gotten all the answers, haven't been allowed to visit some of the sites. But Iran's program is basically at a beginning level. That is, they've acquired illegally the technologies to build centrifuges. They got that through the AQCON network running out of Pakistan. And they've acquired some of the ability to turn their uranium, which they have in mines in Iran into uranium gas, uranium hexafluoride it's called. But they haven't perfected either the centrifuge techniques or the uranium conversion techniques. That is, the gas that they've been trying to make now for, since the 1990s, is still too impure to use in the centrifuges. It's got too many heavy metals still in that gas. We know that because the IAEA has gone and sampled the gas, something you couldn't detect by the CIA or spy satellites. You have to have inspectors on the ground to do that. The centrifuges are still just a test centrifuge. They have 164 set up at a facility in Natanz. They haven't gotten them to work properly. In order to enrich uranium, you need thousands of centrifuges. Can they build them? Can they get all this to work? Yes, but it takes years. We know this because that's what it takes other countries to do. And we know the relative state of the Iranian engineering ability. So that's why the U.S. intelligence agencies officially estimate in the latest national intelligence estimate that Iran cannot build a nuclear bomb until sometime in the next decade, assuming that today they decide to go all out.
My guest is Joseph Cirincione, Director of Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joseph Cirincione, the Director of Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the co-author of the book Deadly Arsenals, Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Threats. We're talking about Iran, which has refused to comply with the International Atomic Energy Agency's demand to close its uranium enrichment plant. The agency has given Iran 1 month to comply or be reported to the UN Security Council. The International Atomic Energy Agency has gotten a lot of documents from Iran during this process of trying to negotiate with Iran about its weapons program. And some of the new documents that the IAEA got have to do with how Iran got technology and information from the AQ Khan black market. And AQ Khan is considered the father of the Pakistani bomb, and he had run this black market for nuclear design and technology. What exactly do we know now that Iran got from AQ Khan, and how did they get it?
They got just about everything. AQ Khan ran a, top to bottom, 24/7, call 1-800-AQ-Khan nuclear operation. This, really, if it wasn't for Pakistan, there wouldn't be an Iranian nuclear program. They got the schematics, the designs for making these centrifuges, the essential machine you need to enrich uranium. They got the parts for the centrifuges. They got complete centrifuges. They got technical assistance to assemble these centrifuges. They also, we now know, also got some specific weapons-related technology and information from AQ Khan. And this is the crucial part, because even though Iran conducted all these activities in secret, their storyline is that this was all related to a peaceful nuclear program, that they did violate their treaty obligations by not disclosing these activities, but none of these, they say, were weapons-related. Well, we now have some evidence, and this was just released in the latest report, that they got, they say in the 90s, but it might have been earlier, drawings dated from the late 1980s that included information on how to turn uranium into a metal and how to shape and form that uranium into hemispheric shapes. That has nothing to do with nuclear power. You don't make fuel rods out of uranium metal. The only thing you make out of uranium metal is a nuclear weapon. And so this disclosure has really put Iran on the hot seat. There's other indications that some of the research has been related to nuclear weapons, and I suspect that they certainly have done this kind of work, but this is the most conclusive evidence so far. It's not proof, but it really shows that they were getting a lot more from AQ Khan network than they've let on, and we still don't know the full story.
Well, the fact that Iran has been so enabled nuclearly by the AQ Khan black market network leads to another really frightening subject, which is the possibility of a terrorist nuclear weapon. You know, certainly, don't you think there must be terrorist groups who've bought things from AQ Khan too?
We don't know. It's certainly possible. He was selling it to anybody. We know he sold the materials to Libya, and Libya's turned them all over now, so we have a very good record from there. Iran, we've now got a lot of disclosures from that. We suspect North Korea, apparently the Pakistani officials have told us this, that they sold it. But there's another country we know, and people suspect it might be Saudi Arabia, that was also involved in some of these trades. And we have no information whatsoever on terrorist groups. It's quite possible that a bomb design, for example, which AQ Khan is known to have supplied Libya, was also supplied to a terrorist group.
In terms of the things that you lie awake worrying about, how many points does terrorist nuclear device get, and how many points does Iran get?
The terrorist threat is right up there at the top. That is the most serious danger we face. And here's why. If Iran actually gets a nuclear weapon, say things go horribly wrong over the next 5 to 10 years and they get a nuclear weapon, or even are seen to be racing towards a nuclear weapon, the danger is not that they're going to attack us or Israel with that bomb. No. Deterrence is alive and well. They understand what would happen next. This would be regime suicide. Even a conventional counterattack would devastate the country, knock off the regime. The danger is rather what other countries in the region do. What does Saudi Arabia do, a country that had financed the Pakistan nuclear program? What does Egypt do, a country that used to have a nuclear program, gave it up voluntarily in the 60s? Or Turkey, or even the new government of Iraq? What happens is the danger that there'd be this nuclear reaction chain that would quickly go from one nuclear power in the Middle East to two, three, or four. That's the danger you worry about. But the terrorist threat, while a low-risk threat, a terrorist can't build their own nuclear bomb from scratch, but they could steal one. They could steal the material, the uranium or the plutonium for a bomb, and then probably assemble it, particularly if they just bought the design from AQ Khan. That is more of a danger because it's very hard to deter terrorists. If Al-Qaeda had a nuclear weapon, they would probably use it. They don't have territory or a national future to defend. In a desperate situation, they could use it or threaten to use it, in nuclear blackmail. The U.S. should pull out of the Middle East or else we'll blow up New York, that kind of threat. And that is the worst nuclear nightmare out there. Fortunately, we have some programs in place that can prevent terrorists from getting these materials. We know where most of the material in the world is. We have programs in place that are trying to secure it and eliminate it. The problem is it's not a high priority. We're moving along at a snail's pace on this effort. The programs won't be able to secure the materials in the states of the former Soviet Union, for example, for another 20 or 30 years. And right now, the way the current administration sees it, the Iran case, and before that the Iraq case, is more of a priority because it overlaps with other agendas. And because of that, a much greater focus gets put on this country threat than on the more serious threat, the threat that a terrorist could get a bomb, that Osama bin Laden could get a bomb and use it against us.
Do you think that the chaos in Iraq now is affecting the nuclear future? Is it affecting terrorist groups getting access to nuclear weapons technologies? Is it affecting anything on the nuclear front?
Without a doubt. The war in Iraq has made the terrorism problem worse. This is actually the official U.S. government position. Our director of the CIA, Porter Goss, testified last year before the Senate that the terrorism problem has grown worse because of the war in Iraq. It has opened up a whole country that was not a terrorist threat before the war, and it's allowed it to become a staging area and a training ground for Al-Qaeda terrorists. Now, most of the insurgents in Iraq are not Islamic fundamentalist terrorists, but there is, according to our official estimates, and outside experts tend to agree, maybe 5% of the activity is being conducted by Al-Qaeda, maybe 1,000 up to 6,000 Al-Qaeda-type terrorists. And they're training, they're growing there. But more importantly, Al-Qaeda-ism, the ideology, has spread like wildfire through the Muslim world as a result of the war in Iraq. So you have recruits streaming in. You have people protecting Al-Qaeda operatives. Osama bin Laden still hasn't been caught, you know, hiding out, getting sanctuary in Pakistan or Afghanistan. And as this global struggle sort of intensifies, you increase the possibility that these groups will be able to recruit insiders, maybe Chechens, maybe Pakistanis, people who already have access to materials. My top threat is not, frankly, Iran. The country I consider the most dangerous country in the world right now is Pakistan, because there you have this volatile mix of a country with nuclear weapons, enough material for 30 or 50 nuclear weapons, a relatively unstable government, a strong Islamic fundamentalist movement in the country, and armed Islamic fundamentalist groups, perhaps Osama bin Laden himself. That's a recipe for disaster. If something should happen to President Musharraf, and there have been several assassination attempts in the last 2 years, who gets the weapons? Who gets the scientists? Who gets the materials? You could go from a U.S. ally to your worst nightmare overnight. That's why you can't just try to focus all your energies on this crisis of the moment. You have to have a systematic approach that deals with all the nuclear dangers at the same time. We can do this kind of thing, which is not.
You're saying that Pakistan is your biggest nuclear nightmare, and as you've pointed out right now, Pakistan is our ally. So, you know, what could we possibly do now to make Pakistan less likely to be the cause of the spread of nuclear weapons, or, you know, worst case scenario, nuclear weapons in the hands of terrorists?
Well, in all these areas, we're doing some of the things already. For example, we're encouraging India and Pakistan to improve their relations and establish the kind of confidence-building measures that the United States and Russia built up over the years of the Cold War. Pakistan-India relations are better than ever. That reduces the chance that one of those countries is going to feel the need to actually start deploying the weapons. It increases confidence that in the two countries' activities, so no one misinterprets an action by one of the other countries. We are quietly talking with Pakistan and helping them develop mechanisms for better securing their nuclear materials. But we could be doing a lot more. We could be spending a lot more time on the South Asia problem. And instead of, unfortunately, as the president has done, encouraging India's nuclear program by announcing a plan to drop all our nuclear trade restrictions that we've had on India for the last 30 years and actually start selling them sensitive nuclear technology, we could be doing the opposite. We could be trying to work with India to get and Pakistan to get both of them to draw down their nuclear arsenals, to pull back from the nuclear brink, and establishing programs to better secure the arsenals within Pakistan in particular, and pressuring Musharraf to help us get a real hold of the AQ Khan network. We still don't know if this network has been fully disassembled. AQ Khan and his cohorts are still living in luxury in Islamabad and other cities in Pakistan. There's a whole host of things you could move more aggressively on, but we're not, because basically of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We feel we need Pakistan to be our ally. It's the historic mistake we've always made. There's always been some other strategic purpose we thought was more important than containing Pakistan's nuclear program, so we allowed it to go. It also, unfortunately, fits in to the current view of how you deal with proliferation. The administration believes there's sort of, you know, good proliferation and bad proliferation. So it's okay that India has nuclear weapons. It's Iran that we have to stop. It's okay that Pakistan has nuclear weapons. It's North Korea that we have to stop. But by trying to pick these good guys and bad guys, you overlook the basic fact of history. Good guys and bad guys keep changing. Iran used to be a good guy. He was our policeman in the Middle East. We sold the Shah of Iran their first nuclear reactor. We, and some of the same officials that are in power today, Donald Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz just left the administration, but in the 1970s, they were part of the Ford administration that encouraged the Shah of Iran to go ahead on a nuclear program, even though we knew he had secretly was doing research on nuclear weapons. We empowered this whole effort. And by the way, the Iranians remember this, even if most Americans don't.
My guest is Joseph Cirincione, Director of Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joseph Cirincione. He's Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. If Iran continues to defy the International Atomic Energy Agency and continues to pursue its nuclear program. Does that jeopardize the whole future of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and does that kind of undermine the chances for controlling nuclear weapons in other countries in the future?
Yes, absolutely. If Iran is allowed to get away with this, if they're allowed to have, now we know, violate their treaty obligations, failing to disclose their activities, perhaps, probably, secretly pursuing a nuclear bomb program, not just a peaceful program, then it undermines confidence in all the treaties and all the regimes, stirs up fears in the countries around Iran, and could be the event, the straw that breaks the non-proliferation treaty regime's back, and could lead to people losing confidence in this entire international system of treaties, restraints, inspections that we've painstakingly assembled over the last 40 years.
We're just about out of time. I'm wondering if you could give us some advice about what we should be looking for in the news in the next few weeks as we try to read between the lines in the developing story on Iran and its nuclear strategy.
The thing to keep in mind is that no country has ever been coerced into giving up a nuclear program. But lots of countries have been convinced to do so. This has got to be a decision that the Iranian government itself makes. The way Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, all those countries, Libya most recently, decided to abandon nuclear programs, in some cases, stockpiles of nuclear weapons. What you want to look for is evidence that Iran is feeling the heat, that the international alliance is holding strong, that Russia and China are holding strong, that you want to look for fissures within Iran, other statements by Khatami or in the Iranian parliament that there's disagreement with President Ahmadinejad's policies. You want to look at interviews that are being done with Iranians on the street who are strongly in favor of a nuclear power program but are not in favor of a nuclear weapons program, at least not at this point. And you want to see if a compromise can be reached with Iran that would allow the power program to go forward, but allow, as at least a temporary measure, all the enrichment activity to continue to take place in Russia. Those are the kind of signs you're looking for. It's going to play out over 3 or 4 months. There's not an imminent military threat here. Iran is not going to break out with a nuclear bomb, but you do have this imminent sort of diplomatic crisis. Can the UN Security Council hold together? Can the leading nations, the permanent members of the Security Council, maintain their unity? If the U.S. plays this well, you should be seeing a series of resolutions coming out of the Security Council, carefully calibrated to keep everyone together, to keep the pressure on Iran, contain the program as long as possible, and allow political developments in Iran to convince that government that its future is better served with a truly peaceful nuclear program than it is by trying to pursue a nuclear weapons program.
Do you think that there are any carrots we could be offering Iran?
Right now, we have a pretty good combination of carrots and sticks on the table, and there's a lot that Iran could gain by agreeing to give up its program, including a trade and cooperation agreement with Europe, which is worth billions of dollars. But the real carrots it needs are ones we haven't yet offered. The kind of offer we made to North Korea, the United States should now be making to Iran. That is explicitly telling them that if this nuclear program issue is resolved, then the U.S. could move towards restoring full diplomatic relations to Iran and reaching a security agreement with Iran so that we would no longer threaten the Iranian government or have as our goal the removal of the Iranian government. The other carrot is to give the Iranians a way out, to make them see this process, their concession, if you will, as part of an effort that would lead to a Middle East free of nuclear weapons, that you make them sort of part of the solution and not just part of the problem. All successful negotiations have to end with both sides being able to leave the table and declare a victory. You've got to give the Iranians a way to do what you want them to do, but save some face in the process.
Joseph Cerincione, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me, Terry.
Joseph Cerincione is the Director of Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.